Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
At Parker, our purpose is simple. We want to make the world a better place. By working more efficiently, by using more sustainable practices, by developing better technologies, we keep moving forward. With each new idea, innovation, and partnership, we're one step closer to fulfilling our purpose every single day. To find out more, visit parker.com/purpose. Parker, engineering your success.
Welcome back to The Peripheral. On this episode, we're going to be hearing two stories, one about prescription addiction and one about drinking. Now, they are two very different stories, but both of these stories hit very close to home for me because of the events and details that happened. It reminds me of my family, my brother, my friends. If you combine these two stories, you have a large portion of my life. The first story is Jeremiah, who is in a difficult situation where he has serious back pain because he's overweight. The only thing that gets him out of this are pain pills, but the pain pills tend to be worse than the original problem. Imagine sinking in quicksand and somebody hands you a limb. But when you reach out and grab that limb, it's covered with thorns, and it's your only salvation, but now you're stuck to it.
Hello.
Jeremiah.
This is him. Hey, Justin.
How you doing?
Good, man. Good. I grew up suburbs of Detroit, you know, had a pretty normal life, you'd say. In my childhood or bad things happening to me growing up, you know, for that you could find a direct cause or reason. It's a pretty normal life. You know, I went to college, got a decent job after college, worked a good 10 years possibly, maybe. So we're talking early to mid 30s now is when my problem with opiates began to unfold. I'm some may say a large individual, about 6'7", depending on the day, 450, 500 pounds.
You're a damn linebacker, yeah. Man.
yeah. So, but at this point in time, we're probably talking 2012, 2011, I had started to get dangerously above overweight. Like when I'm around 450 or 5, being as tall as I am, luckily I can hide it pretty well, or at least deal with it and get around and do pretty much what I need to do without any obstructions. But as I said, I started to get up to around 600 pounds and then over 600 pounds. So now it's at the point where every time I get out of bed, it's my back's hurting. Every time I get in and out of a car, it's a struggle.
What's your occupation? What were you doing?
I was a network administrator slash staff accountant. So I have a degree in accounting, but it was a desk job. So yeah. I sat at a desk 10 hours a day, 8 to 10 hours a day.
You don't move.
No.
I've had that same job. I mean, people think truck drivers, people think things that require you to sit, but most corporate jobs, desk jobs, you don't move, and they don't, not that it's anyone's responsibility to tell you to get up and move around, but I remember I was getting very out of shape and having high blood pressure, having, I mean, I would get winded just walking up a flight of stairs. So I, you know.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, on your breaks, it's when you get up and go walk around. You know, a lot of people on their breaks, they rest. But, yeah, in the office on a break, you go walk around the warehouse, or try to get the blood circulating real quick. There are days where, you know, I would be seated for 12 hours. Yeah, so that, I'm sure that didn't help my situation. Yeah, I'm 6'25", give or take, and barely can move now. And I go to the doctor and say, you know, so I describe my symptoms, what's going on. And, you know, he gives me, I believe it the first time, he prescribed me like 30 hydrocodones at a small strength, like I think it was 500 milligrams or 750. Yeah, those worked great at first. You know, the first month was great. I took them as prescribed. I took one a day or sometimes two, but, you know, never wasn't running out or anything. And I was able to get to the start going back to the gym. Now, this is a slow process, mind you. It took 15 months of this, and, you know, every month I would go see the doctor, and slowly, you know, in my head, I thought I was getting better, but looking back, you know, I knew what I was doing. Like, it was slowly increasing. Like, it was 45 pills a month, then 60, then 90, then 120. And before I know it, like I said, 15, 18 months later, I'm getting 120,000 milligram hydrocodones.
That's a month?
A month, yes. And I was, however, 200 pounds lighter because I was able to get to the gym and return to an active lifestyle. But I had wound up with an incredible opiate addiction at the same time. So, you know, the doctor never asked any questions or seemed all that concerned. They were just, whatever I said, they'd just write me more.
It's terrible, though, because on one side, yes, it is helping you because you are in constant pain. And if you're in pain, you can't go move around. You can't go and exercise because it's too inconvenient. But when you feel better, you can go do these things. But now you've pretty much accomplished a full-on opiate addiction, right?
Oh, indeed. I was running out. I'd have to take 5 in the morning to get out of bed. You know, I had a circle of people that would sell their scripts, and I knew what days they got them and how many days I'd be without if I took all of mine. And, you know, it was down to a pretty crazy science. And so, I come from Monroe, Michigan, and that, not anymore, I moved, but there is an absolute epidemic in that city, and there's just a pharmacy on every corner, and there's one popping up every other week, it seems. If people aren't taking the pills, they're selling theirs, or they're on heroin. People literally overdose on their lunch breaks at the Meyer there. It happened more than once.
Do you think that's because there's nothing to do in the town, or do you think it's just people have this, it's like a pretty much a demand and supply, people want it, so more pharmacies open up? And what do you think is kind of the root cause there? Do you have an opinion?
Yeah, I've asked myself that question a lot of times in the last couple of years, you know, trying to get to the root cause of, you know, at least what happened to me. And the most I can come up with is that because it's from a doctor, you know, people initially think, oh, it's fine, it's okay. And that's how I think that's how it traps a lot of people. Now, granted, there's a lot of people that are just abusing the system and just want their high and their fix. And there's always going to be that segment of people. But I think a lot of the reason why it's an epidemic at this point is because it can, like, take a person who's not, that is not necessarily, has no history of using drugs, or illicit drugs, and it can, you know, because it's coming from a doctor, you think it's okay, and
there's
then
there's no stigma,
you know, so there's not the stigma that's with, you know, like cocaine or something that's illegal technically. So I think people think it's okay at first, and that's the danger, most dangerous time is initially when they're getting the buzz and the euphoria and they get wrapped up in it and think it's okay, and it just destroys them.
So 15 months, you have gone from, what was it, 500 milligram to 1,000 milligram and four times the amount of pills.
Four times the amount, twice the strength, yep.
And are you interpreting the pain you feel now, like anytime the drugs would start to wear off, I'm sure that you were going through withdrawal, but at the same time you might feel that the withdrawal pains, or you might misinterpret those pains as your back issue or other issues coming back.
And this is the kicker of the whole thing. When I'm after the 200 pounds was gone, I guess it's not really that surprising, but at 200 pounds less, you know, go figure, I don't have back pain. There was no back problems when I lost 200 pounds. I was purely taking them for the high at that point. Like I had long since passed of it suppressing my pain. I mean, yeah, to get to that level, indeed, for the first, I don't know, 60-70% at this point, it was alleviating the pain to get to the gym. And, you know, at this time I was doing hour and a half on the ellipticals with full sweatpants and sweatshirt. And
good just, for you, man.
Yeah, awesome. Just killing it, man. And but yeah, I had zero back pain, and but here I am, absolutely out of control, isolated, completely addicted to opiates. It didn't matter. Norcos, hydrocodone, morphine, Oxycontin, whatever I could get. It did not matter. I had a decent amount of money. I'm not married. I don't have any children. It was a free-for-all. It wasn't like a slow fall. It was, you know, like I jumped off a building, but it was a really high building. I was able to fool myself and my family for a while. My work moved about 10 years ago, and instead of doing the commute, I moved down there and away from my family. And yeah, so anyway, I'm out of control, just like I said, spending tons of money and time. But for a while, I was able to be functional somewhat. You know, I was managed to hold down my job. I'm not sure how, but in August of 2013, or about that 15-month frame, give or take, I had my first overdose. I had some fentanyl, which that shit, no one needs to be messing with that stuff. Mm-hmm. That stuff is stronger than heroin, they say. I don't know.
But it's legal, right?
Oh, it's legal, yeah.
Perfectly legal.
Yep, and they come in patches, like lollipops. People lick them and throw patches on there. Or, you know, some people suck on the patches. And it's just a super intense, probably the strongest opiate buzz you can get, I imagine. And I did too many. I was taking other things that night also, like benzos, like some Xanax and other opiates. But for the most part, it was the fentanyl. And, yeah, I was at my girlfriend's house, and we were going to go to a music festival, and I went on the porch to make a phone call and smoke a cigarette, and I woke up on the back of an ambulance, and, you know, I mentioned my size before, and I'm like, ripping these, they had the tubes in my nose, and, you know, we're things hooked up to me, and I'm ripping them off, and didn't know where I was at first. And, you know, once I figured out where I was able to calm down, and they got me, you know, sedated, and they, or whatever they did, I don't know, but they gave me the Narcan shot, which I don't know if you've heard, but it's very unpleasant.
Yeah.
It snaps you out of whatever opiate you're on. It basically nullifies the whole, all the symptoms and all the consequences, and it's a lifesaver. but it's very unpleasant. It feels like you're on fire. You know, my girlfriend being there probably saved my life, because if she wouldn't have been there to get emergency services there right away, I could be a vegetable. I could be dead. Who knows? You know, that should have been rock bottom. It really, like, and for a couple months, I thought it was. You know, I didn't touch anything for a couple weeks after that. You know, it scared me. You know, I was in a neck brace. You know, I had a big ass shiner from where I fell.
Did you seek any rehab help to get off of the pills?
Yes. No, not, I didn't do enough, but, I've been to quite a few NA meetings, about this time. I started going, and also was, my parents had me get into some counseling also. So I was seeing some pretty, I'd say as much outpatient as you could probably do. I was seeing a counselor a few times a week. I did like 30 NA meetings in 30 days. In my mind, I was trying to, you know, combat this thing. I was able to stay straight for a little while, but we're creatures of habit. So after a few months, you know, just slowly started falling back into the old ways. And we're in 2014 at this point. You know, still somehow have my job. Still hiding everything from my employer, and start to go back to the doctor one day, and that I had been to, and he didn't ask me where I'd been or why I hadn't seen me in the month or two that I hadn't been there. Or, you know, just was back on it, and you know, just took off again.
How much did he prescribe you when you came back?
Same, 120. Just got right back on what I was getting. 120 pills, 1,000 milligrams.
Do doctors not even think 120 pills is... It seems like such a outrageous amount to me, but...
It really is. And I know people... Like, I'm a big dude, but I know this woman. She's 5 foot nothing, 120 pounds, soaking wet. And they prescribe her 180. And along with benzos and muscle relaxers, it's like if she was to take what she's actually prescribed, she'd be a zombie. I can't fathom it sometimes.
I have a family member who they prescribe her, I think it's 260 Xanax a month. 260.
Wow.
Just take out of consideration that that's too much humanly possible that for them to take that without dying. Are they not accountable for when that person is now turning around and selling those pills? Because there's no way that they would take that many. So now they're selling to people that either A, can't get a prescription, or B, are abusing their prescription and need more, such as in your case. I mean, when...
Exactly.
So you're back on them now.
Yes, I'm back on them full swing. Everyone in my position has a few dealers on their speed dial. You know, you don't just have one. Mine tend to like me for some reason, probably because all the money I give them. If they don't hear from me in a while, they would call and check up on me, see what was going on, you know. And we're at this point, we're up to September of 2014. I'm at work. Just, you know, it was a normal day for me, but... You know, this day I was high on, it was Percocet or hydrocodone, or both maybe, but I was coming back from lunch, and I ran up the curb and hit like a stone that was in the parking lot. Like, you know, didn't do any damage, really. I mean, I put a nice dent in my car, but unfortunately, a few people saw it. They reported me to HR. I was obviously intoxicated, but I don't think they didn't know like what I was on. They might have thought I was drunk, I think. I don't know. And at this point, I had 14 years there. This is my 14th year. And so, you know, the vice president comes in and takes all my keys. And because after 14 years, you know, I had a lot of codes and passwords. And,
oh, yeah.
a lot of stuff, and so I had to turn all that in, and you know, he just told me to go home, and you know, he'd be in touch. So I'm freaking out, thinking I lost my job. I don't know what I'm gonna do. I started the unemployment process, and after a few days go by, they call me, and luckily for me, I'd been there so long, no one knew how to do my job. So, you know, they kept me on as like a consultant for a while. Like, basically, I trained the person to take over my job remotely. So I was fired, but not fired. So this was September of 2014. You know, I'm working remotely sometimes, you know. I knew I could read the writing on the wall. I was fired, but I was going to help train my replacement. So I move out of Monroe, move in with my girlfriend, which wasn't how I planned for us to move in together. But, you know, she's wonderful. And if I haven't said it, she's her and my mother, the only reason that I'm alive today. But I move in with my girlfriend, and I get a job delivering pizzas. And before that, I skipped over a story, but I completely wrecked my car. I had a Trailblazer, you know, loaded, had the DVR player and nice leather seats and everything. It was a really nice car. Completely one day, just crashed it.
Did you hit
it was
person?
A one car accident. Okay. You know, I ran over it wasn't a stop sign, but it was a street sign. Just completely tore up the undercarriage of the Trailblazer. The cops showed on the scene. Thought I was drunk. Gave me a breathalyzer. Gave me a field sobriety. I passed it. They wrote me a reckless driving ticket. Yeah, they did, but I didn't get arrested for some reason. Because I was lucky. Lucked out.
It's because you weren't drinking. If you had been, you would have been arrested, but they couldn't pin anything on you. They couldn't prove anything because the laws just aren't written that way. It's a whole other
works
podcast
for me, but it's scary, you know. Yeah, we can open that Pandora's box, but luckily, you know, I'm able to quickly get a rental and get my car towed to get fixed. Well, long story short, I wrecked the rental. It was a 2014 Camaro. I don't know why they rented me a Camaro, but they did. Same deal. It was in a different city. I think had it been in the same city, I'd probably be screwed, but it was a different city. Again, they tried to breathalyze me, field sobriety, passed them. Same ticket exactly that I got the other time. One would think, okay, like, this is enough. Like, you got to stop what you're doing. So now we're back to where I moved into my girlfriend's. Not under good circumstances. And, you know, I'm not working. I'm working sparingly when this job calls me to train the person who's replacing me, which wasn't 40 hours a week. It was here and there when couldn't figure out what to do. They'd call me and walk them through some things. So I wasn't making much money. So I took on a job delivering pizzas. It sucked, but it was money. You know, it wasn't the hardest job. Things were going okay. I was using still. I wasn't anywhere near so clean and sober. I'm just still in a total wreck. But, you know, I'm trying. I am still actively going to NA, actively seeing a therapist, completely fooling myself. Or not, at this point, I wasn't fooling myself. I didn't care. It wasn't that I wanted to die, or I was looking to die, or I was suicidal, because I didn't feel suicidal at all. I didn't care. Like, I was so numb to everything from the drug, from the opiates. I just had no feeling. I was just a walking zombie. It was like I was barely human. I'm trying, and I know I have a huge problem. I know I'm gonna die or be in jail if I don't stop, but it still didn't stop me. So one night I'm delivering pizzas. Honestly, like, I was not even doing them this night. I was withdrawing. This particular pizza joint was open till 3 a.m, so that's some late deliveries. So I'm like on my last delivery, really late one of the night. You know, I'm driving and sweating, not feeling good. You know, you can read the symptoms. You know, you sweat your ass off. You start shitting your pants, and it's unpleasant. So I'm trying to just wrap things up for the night and get home and sleep or try to do something.
Sounds like hell, man.
Forget. Blacked out completely. Like, I don't even remember this accident. I remember zero. I'm driving to my last pizza delivery of the night, and I come to. I'm walking through the neighborhood, the middle of the night, trying to find my car. I walk around for a half hour, can't find my car. I'm like, luckily again, like right on the border between two cities. So I was in a city where the accident didn't happen, so that's probably the only reason they didn't find me walking along the street. My girlfriend's house wasn't too far away, so I couldn't find my car, so I to her house, and I didn't have my phone either. So I do the track, where's my iPhone app real quick, pull that up, and oh, it's at my local police station. So I'm like, fuck. So yeah, so apparently I hit a telephone pole, DTE pole, and not one car accident.
So at least it's has been one car accident this whole time, and you haven't heard anyone
how,
else.
Honestly, like that, it's like, how can I not believe someone was looking out for me? But anyway.
So you call the police?
Yeah. I call them and say who I am. They're like, yeah, we just towed your car and need you to come down and fill out a statement. So I'm like, okay, this is it. The ride's over. I'm going to jail. Like, go here, and I'm walking the door. They're going to arrest me, and maybe this will be what I need, or, you know, at least this is going to be the end. So I make my way up to the police station, and again, they patter me with the sobriety test and the breathalyzer. I pass them. And long story short, they just had me write a statement, gave me another careless driving and a leaving the scene, but let me, you know, I wasn't arrested or anything, and went back home for the night. And this was rock bottom, though. This was the end. This is where it turned around. And a couple days later, my mother had called up one of my childhood friends and told him what was going on. So he showed up at my house one morning at like 6:30, bunch of coffees, and he's like, yeah, we got some talking to do. And we drove around, and, you know, he just kind of, you know, laid things out, and he goes, it was things I knew. Yeah, you know, sometimes you need the right person to say it to you, I guess. You know, he's like, you got to do some kind of rehab 24, you know, 7 days a week till you get stable, and you're, you know, just what you're putting a Band-Aid on everything. And yeah, he just kind of laid things on the line and, you know, let me know what I was doing to my mother, because she had the police knocking on her door looking for me that night where I did the hit and run and came back to the scene. You know, they came to her house looking for me, and, you know, just the things I put her and my girlfriend through, and, you know, just how deep of a hole I'd gotten into, what I needed to do to get out of it, and, you know, how many, you know, I had people in my corner that were there for me, that were, you know, wanting me to get out of this, and, you know, I hadn't burnt all the bridges yet. There's still people, you know, that cared about me and all that stuff, and for me, that was a turning point. You know, I signed up at a methadone clinic the next day, and I haven't been back to the opiates since this was October of 2014.
And technically, all the drugs you were using were legal prescription drugs, correct?
They're all prescribed RXs.
Wow. And methadone works the same way on these opiates as it does on heroin.
I think I was probably a special case, but yeah, it can. It worked for me. For me, I had done every kind of therapy you can think of, but I never addressed the physical side. You know, I was always doing NA meetings and talking about it and trying to do the behavioral side of it, but not addressing the physical side. So, you know, this time I was, you know, I wasn't going back this time. So,
how long have you been clean now?
Well, it's October 2014, so almost 2 years at this point. But you know, and a lot of people say you're not really clean when you're taking methadone. You know, that's the another stigma that's out there, but that's okay. You know, I don't really care what if people think I'm clean or not. I know I am, and I know I'm not where I was. So, but right now I'm on a blind dose, and I'm at a really low dose, and I'm working to hopefully be out of that soon. You know, if I feel like I'm going back to it, I can always go back. But yeah, it's been a long, long, long road of just a downward spiral, and you know, a lot of it was my doing. But there's a lot of people in my position, so I can't be. There's obviously something's wrong. Something's not working right that needs to be addressed.
How are your back problems now? How's your weight? Like, have you been doing in those areas?
You know, my weight right now, I'm probably about 525, give or take. I lost 200, gained 100 back. It's manageable with Aleve or Tylenol right now. I try to stay active and do the stretching and the right way to do things, you know, keep my core strong so the back doesn't hurt.
If you were talking to somebody else who was overweight, was having pain issues, and is starting to use drugs, starting to use pain meds, what would your advice be to them?
Unless you're a type of person that can, you know, take one when you really only need it and put it away, I'd say do everything you can in your power to find an alternative. You know, it doesn't, it's amazing what some exercise and stretching will do. Just be careful is what I tell them. You know, it's a strange place to be, you know, with a doctor or something that you trust telling you that there's nothing wrong with taking this stuff. You can get fooled, but just be aware of the consequences. You know, it's not worth it in the end. If unless you absolutely need them, it's not worth it.
Somehow every doctor I've ever had in my life has been one of those Nazi prescribers where they don't prescribe you anything. So I've rarely ever been written a prescription for anything unless like it's like amoxicillin because I'm sick. Meanwhile, if I ever wanted Xanax, Ambien, any kind of pain pill I want, all I have to do is pick up the phone and ask any one of my friends or family members, because all of them get overprescribed to the point where they could hand me 20 pills and not even think about it.
They're kind of starting to reform it. I don't know if you've heard, but like they're starting to make people like test like the levels of this stuff in their blood, so they know like if you haven't taken them for the month, they can start telling that, and they'll cut people off supposedly. Now, how soon that's going to be, and how much they're going to enforce it, and how long it's going to take to get applied, who knows? But I've seen a couple people I know that were prescribed. My girlfriend was prescribed Ativan.
Ativan, yeah.
And she was prescribed a real strong, like 2 milligrams, and she really needs it. Like, she's a much stronger person than me. She just uses the things when she needs it, and you know, when she's about to have a panic attack or something. But they made her test to keep getting prescribed Ativan. She has to test. They have to test the levels in her system to make sure that she's taking it the way she should be. Boy, yeah, I just seen it ruin their lives. It's just,
I get
all these people can't be drug addicts.
Yeah, I get it. Like you're saying, you know, everyone's responsible for themselves. Everyone needs to take accountability of their own actions. But there are so many issues here of you don't think that taking one hydrocodone a day is an issue because you're managing pain. And you have that understanding until you're taking 120 a month at double the strength. You did that. You took the pills, but somebody was legally giving those to you. And between the doctor's analysis of you and then the script writing and then the pharmacist filling it, are there no checks and balances? And do we think that all this regulation, all these checks are for something? Because apparently you could get more opiate prescriptions prescribed to you than I could ever find illegal drugs on the street ever.
Mm-hmm.
On one side, yes, you did it. You made the choice. But on the other side, is there not any sort of check and balance to prevent you from becoming addicted? That's my problem. That's the catch 22 mm-hmm. here is.
It really is. It's the things I've witnessed is doctors, you know, meeting up. No, I don't know how these people got their licenses, but meeting people up in parking lots, buying scripts off them for $100 a script, and it's like you walk in these pain clinics. In my area, there's a lot of these urgent cares. They're not really like doctors. They're not hospitals, and they're not like necessarily a doctor's, like a general practitioner's office. They're just a couple doctors on staff with a pharmacy right there. How convenient. Yeah, I think the people just go in there, and you know, the people that are really there for pain, you know, they're the ones that are in there actually in the therapy room, you know, stretching out, working out. And then you got the people that are just for the pills. It's just a revolving door. They just come in, get the pills, and out the door. No one's like really examining them or seeing what's really going on with them. They're just handing them their pills and sending them on their way till the next month.
They just want to pop a pill and problem solved, but we know the reality is they're just using drugs at that point. They're not.
Yeah, and they're just legal drug. Oh, you just call them their opium dens. What's it? They're just like in that movie about Jack the Ripper, man. Might as well be smoking opium in those things.
That's a good comparison.
About a month ago, this guy that he grew up on my street. We were about the same age. I was a couple years older than him. We always run into each other at NA meetings. And we'd always talk afterwards because we'd known each other since we were little kids riding bikes around the neighborhood. You know, we'd always share our stories, and you know, he would come over and did landscaping at my house, and we always sit and talk, and, you know, about our problems and where we were at and how glad we were. And he had like a 6-year-old boy and a fiance, and a month ago still, and 5-6 days later across Facebook, his fiance posts something saying he just passed away. So, you know, I didn't have to ask what it was or what happened. I knew. No one still told me yet what happened, but I know I don't have to ask. I know he OD'd. And it's just, you know, he was three, four weeks ago, we were sitting in my living room telling stories. And, you know, I gave him $50 to do my fucking landscaping. You know, he's dead, and he leaves behind the kid and the fiance. It's eye-opening. Let's see what can happen. And just makes you appreciate things more, that's for sure, every day. And how time is the most important commodity you have in life, and it's got to treasure it.
It's just weird. I think differently than most. I understand that, but I look at a family member died from a heroin overdose. The police would want to go after the dealer and say, well, you're the one that killed them. And most of the public's opinion is, oh, well, you sold that person heroin. They overdosed on the heroin, so now, therefore, you're responsible. But if a doctor prescribes you 120 opiate pills and you OD, it's like, well, he made a choice. He took too many pills, and it's a weird double standard that I'll never understand.
Yeah, that's definitely true. That was a joke. I think didn't Michael Jackson's doctor serve some time? Or I don't know about that.
I think it was, he might have, but that's such a high-profile thing.
Yeah, exactly. Like,
for your friend that just passed away, is there going to be anyone held accountable for that? Or is it just going to be another dead junkie? It's sad because people don't have more empathy. They don't sympathize with someone's situation.
Oh, no. And this will take it to another level here, but and maybe my family felt this way at one time, but when he passed, my friend Scott, parents and brother came to his house where his fiance was at with his kid, took his kid, told her they weren't having a funeral. His body was cremated already or was about to be. They weren't having a service, and you know, she could probably see the kid if she wanted to keep seeing him. And they left. You know, they were already prepared for this moment, and they had been prepared for a long time. And you know, maybe that's all it is when you do that to your relatives long enough. Maybe that's the point some of them get to. I don't know. Yeah, so I actually took it upon myself to have a memorial service for him next weekend. And I was informed his family won't be coming. Okay, thanks.
I've been in his family's shoes. I mean, my brother was a chaotic mess by the end of his life. And I would have gone to his service if we had one, but my mother didn't. So I get the frustration and the writing them off, but still a human being. And
exactly. All right, man. Well, appreciate it. And
thank
you. Forward to listening to your stuff, man. Yeah. Thank you for putting it out.
No problem. Thank you, Jeremiah. Next up, I speak with Dave. Much like the first story, Dave lost many years, destroyed a lot of relationships, and wasted a lot of money on an addiction that he tried to break himself from. But with all the help and all the outside forces, he just couldn't seem to pull himself away from it.
Oh, how you been?
I'm good, man. I've been thinking about how to start this thing off.
it's rough.
There's too many details, and I'll probably miss a bunch of them, but we'll see what the moral of the story is behind there, because I still don't know where it is.
Do you want to share your name?
Yes, my name's Dave. I know Justin through the Generation Y podcast. Long-time listener, first-time caller. And when I saw that the premise of this new podcast that you're doing, I thought it was appropriate that I share my story. You know, I have a lot of stories, but as far as it pertains to substance use and mostly alcohol, but I did everything.
Usually alcohol leads to other stuff.
The reason I kind of want to share my story is because once upon a time ago, around 2013, maybe early 2014, I started going to AA meetings. It always appealed to me that a lot of the speakers at the meetings, they have they're called speaker meetings. The format is usually somebody will go for about an hour telling their story, and then you can breaks off and you can, you know, insert your, you know, whatever you want to say. But I never got a chance to do that because you need 3 months of sobriety, and I never did that.
Wow.
Well, because I do not go to AA meetings anymore.
Yeah. That's a whole other conversation.
Yeah. I'll insert some of my feelings on that once we get to that point, because that was one of the more recent chapters.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't really start drinking or really doing anything in high school. I was pretty well behaved. I mean, I had a beer or two with my friends. You know, if we snuck it, you know, we would sneak a, you know, pack of cigarettes or something like that. But really nothing abrasive. Even in college, my freshman year, I remember coming home from the weekend, and I'd get back there on Monday, and the dorm would be completely trashed, and I would flip out because there would be beer cans everywhere, and I remember one time they took the door hinges off and used it as a beer pong table.
Yeah, of course.
And it was my closet. At that point in time, I absolutely hated it. I don't really think I had my first legitimately drunk experience until I was maybe close to 21. It wasn't pleasant. I think I was home with my parents, and I think I drank, like, there's this one drink. Have you ever heard of a black tooth grin?
No. What is it? Is it liquor or beer?
It's, if you know the band Pantera,
yes.
Obviously, Dimebag Darrell, he made a drink called black tooth grin. It's 2 shots of Jaeger, a shot of Jack, and a shot of Coke. I drank 4 of those and like 5 shots of Parrot Bay in the span of like 20 minutes. Destroyed my upstairs bathroom. My mom never knew about it. My dad said, you keep it quiet as long as I never did it again. Well, it probably happened on the regular for the next friggin' decade.
Yeah.
I was usually pretty well behaved until maybe around like 23, and I found this local bar around me that had karaoke on Sundays. Went there, had a good time, found out they had it on Thursdays, started going on Thursdays. So now I'm drinking Sunday, Thursday, found another place on Wednesday, started going there. And because it's Friday and Saturday, now I'm drinking Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Wednesday, Thursday. So you end up being drunk more than not. I don't think I realized this at the time, but I dropped out of school after my freshman year of college. At the time, I thought it was because I didn't know what I wanted to do. But looking back on it, I think it was just because I preferred to have fun. I didn't really have a job. Every now and again, if I needed money, I would go snooping around the house until I found a $100 bill or something, try to make that last me. I did that for a good while. In that span of finding fun, as I like to call it, I stopped spending time with my fiance. I was 22. I was engaged to her for a year. She caught me cheating with somebody that I met out at the bars.
Just some random girl.
Yeah, I think I spent 2 months with that girl. Yeah, it wasn't a very good return policy. When you meet somebody they're hooking up with and you lose your fiance, nah, it didn't really work.
I have a lot of friends that were in like a party mode in high school, and they just kind of never grew up, never got out of the party mode. And it sounds like your party mode started maybe later.
It started a lot later. Eventually, I started slowing down at the bars and started just drinking at home. Even such things like, I remember there was one time I had to babysit my nephews, and I somehow couldn't tolerate that. I couldn't let myself just like hanging out and have fun with them. I think they were like 12. If I would get like a second, I would go off and like sneak a shot of whiskey about 10 times.
Just to cope.
Throughout the course of the night. And I think one time they asked me why I was slurring my words. Thank God that Nat never
came back.
Oh, God. And I think that's, I've been saying this for years now, that I just never wanted the party to stop because I associated the drunk feeling good feelings with that.
With the good time.
Yeah. I think I was arrested 4 times.
Four. I've only been arrested 3 times in my life.
they were all only 3 times. That ain't shit, man.
You got me beat.
Yeah, right. They were all alcohol related, and they were all subsequent years, all in October. So I got arrested 4 Octobers in a row, which seems kind of strange. Within a week of Halloween, too.
That was just your time when you.
Yeah, I don't know why, but every time it seemed like I was really lucky with the way that things were. Maybe I should maybe rewind to each of those times.
Sure. Yeah, let's start with the first one, if you don't mind.
Yeah, the first one was the weekend before Halloween. One of my friends that worked out at one of the bars that I frequented, she was going to another place. I think it was actually like a gay bar she hung out at with every now and again. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've never been there. It's not really my scene, so I'll check it out. Everybody kept buying me double shots.
Of course.
I drove home, blacked out. My dad answers the door. It's just hard to think about some of this stuff sometimes. I remember him saying, "This is it. Never again. You know, it's over." And I kept saying, "What's over? I don't know what your problem is. You know, just the shit you're doing. You know, you're going down the wrong path, and you're killing yourself. And this isn't you." And then I started screaming, crying, started throwing punches at him. He tackles me in my bedroom upstairs. My mom calls the cops. The cops come up to my bedroom and say that they're not really trying to arrest me or anything. It looks like they just want to give me like a nice little talking to. They say, your dad and your parents really care about you, and they want you to stop hurting yourself. I think you should do something about that. I told the cop to go fuck himself.
Of course. The cops are actually being cool. They're doing their job. They're not coming in and dragging you out into the street.
No.
But you're drunk. Absolutely. You're drunk and you're angry. But
angry at myself.
Yeah.
That's where it was. That's why I was screaming. I wasn't. They might as well have just been like an angel that's trying to like talk you down. Say, like, I don't want to hear it right now. They drug me into the car. I think I was laughing at the time. like hysterically, like in a way that you'd picture somebody on bath salts.
Yeah.
That sort of way.
But you're just drunk.
Yeah, drunk. Incredibly so. Spent the night in the clink. The next day, I started going to therapy twice a week. I went twice a week for a year. It didn't do anything. I never stopped drinking. I think I went to the therapy sessions drunk and or high sometimes.
Oh, jeez.
Just because that's what I did.
It's the party. It doesn't stop.
No. I didn't let myself relax. You're going to find that that's a common theme, that I, for a long, long time, I didn't let myself be in a comfortable or fun environment unless I was somewhat inebriated on some level. It didn't matter what the substance was. Whatever I had my hands on or could think that I could get away with. I remember one time my therapist saying to me that she thinks a lot of alcoholics drink vodka because it's the most easy to cover up on your breath. I just took that as a, maybe I should switch to vodka because it's easier to cover up. Of course.
I drank vodka. That was the first hard liquor I started with. So
yeah.
And I would,
it seems like most people start with that or like Cuervo.
Yeah. You know? I would down a pint of vodka. No breath. Just
it's dude. Easy.
And that would be my night.
Yeah, and you probably didn't think you had enough.
No, I could continue drinking after that. It's pretty bad. So you switched to vodka.
Yeah, right. At least for a little bit, but I don't like vodka very much.
Yeah.
But I digress. I guess we can fast forward to the next time I got arrested. This was before my DUI.
Mm-hmm.
It was a driving incident. I got pulled over maybe about a mile away from my house. The cops pulled me over. I did a field sobriety test. He obviously knows I'm drunk, but he's kind of messing with me. And he keeps asking me questions and just to see what I was doing, what I was drinking. He puts me in his car and I didn't want to call my parents to pick me up because I didn't.
Yeah.
So I called my girlfriend. It's about 3 a.m. She comes and picks me up maybe about an hour and a half later. The whole time I'm sitting in the cop car. Have you ever seen Superbad?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know the interaction that those cops are having with him? It was like that. They were joking around with me the whole time. It was interesting. I felt like they were my friends afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't give me a DUI. I think they wrote me up for speeding 5 miles out over the speed limit. I don't know why, but I figured they might have thought that might have been the most benign of charges that they could do.
They couldn't let you go with nothing. They had to write you up for something.
6 months later, I went to court for that one. The cop meets me in the back office just to talk about what they're going to charge me with and what I can expect. I said that, I just went back to school. I'm doing really well for myself. I started my internship. I'm working 2 part-time jobs. And I'm sorry, I messed up. I'm just really trying hard not to do it anymore. He said, I have a son. What if you killed my son while you're driving? Like, I know that's a reality of drinking and driving, and it's something that could easily happen, especially how many times I had to drive down the road squinting just so I can see the dotted line. Long story short, so you learned your lesson. And I said, I think I did. We went into the courtroom and he told the judge, we're just going to drop it.
Wow.
Yeah. So we dropped it.
Do you think that was a good thing they dropped it or a bad thing they dropped it?
I think you could probably go both ways on that one. I think there's the aspect of tough love, where someone, doesn't just give you the little slap on the wrist and they actually make you pay for your consequences so you actually see an action.
Yeah.
I tried to roll with that for a little bit, but if you keep doing what you're doing, it's eventually going to ramp back up. We're getting to the AA chapter in a little bit. But something I always heard in those rooms was that a lot of times you convince yourself that you can still drink, but in moderation. If you tell yourself that and you do have a problem with either drinking or drugs or whatever it is, gambling, insert the vice here.
Yeah.
You're eventually going to end up exactly where you were, if not in a worse spot. So that's pretty much exactly what happened. A year after that was when I got my actual DUI. Actually, right around the same mile marker that I got pulled over the year before. like within a block of that same street. It was on the same street.
Was it the same cop?
No, but he's going to show up again later. He shows up again later.
Okay.
You're so disgusted.
No. It would have been ironic if he pulled you over and said, I gave you a pass that one time.
Yeah, I knew it.
Yeah.
No, but he absolutely shows up again on the court date for the DUI. I'm waiting in the, just in the little waiting room with my lawyer. I see a truck pull up and I don't know his unit number, but for some reason I knew it was him. And I saw him get out of the car. I'm like, I just know that figure. I know it's going to be him that walks to that door. And he walks out and he's waiting in the lobby. And I come back in and I say, Officer Hendricks, right? And he says, yeah, where do I know you from? And I said, Indiana Jones, which he used to call me because I'm was an archaeology major. And I said, Indiana Jones. It's like, oh, it was disappointing. Oh, no. Come on, man. Like one of those... he wasn't mad, just disappointed.
And that probably made you feel horrible.
Yeah, that was the worst part of it. He was actually the guy that ended up processing me for my fingerprints, you know, taking mugshots and stuff, which is humiliating.
Yeah.
But we did a lot of talking while we were in there. Like, it's nothing too much about legal jargon or anything. We just ended up talking. He actually ended up giving me his number. And said, if you ever need anything or just want to talk or need help with anything at all, just give me a call, which I ended up doing. He, you know, every now and again, I'll have a little chat with him.
Mm-hmm.
He said, next time I see you on the road, I just want to wave. I don't want to be pulling you over.
Putting you in cuffs.
Yeah, no. Yeah, bring them just in case.
Yeah. So that third arrest was a DUI, but you were just driving and got pulled over. You didn't hit anyone or anything.
No, I didn't hit anyone. I didn't hit anything. They said I was speeding, but thinking back on it, I don't think so. I mean, the street they pulled me over, they said that I was going 69 and it's a 30 mile an hour speed limit, but I don't know. You have to really be galloping to get up to 70 miles an hour on that particular street.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably like the least of my worries.
Yeah, yeah.
It was after that I started going to AA meetings. I tried to go as often as possible, maybe two or three times a week, because I thought that that was something that by the time my court date rolled around, I thought it would be something that the judge would like to see. I was expecting mandated AA time or volunteer work. Turns out they didn't expect me to do any of that stuff, and I just did it for myself, I guess. We have a family friend that goes to the meetings, or did go to the meetings. And I called him right away and asked him, you know, if there's any dates going on or anything. And he said, what are you doing tonight? And nothing. So I went to a 7:30 meeting. They gave me a 24-hour sobriety coin. The person heading the meeting hugged me and I cried. It was a very powerful moment. You know, it was a very accepting. I felt like I was where I needed to be at the time. I picked up a sponsor. One of his things was making sure you share something at every meeting. You know, just there's always something on your mind. You need to share it. Inevitably, I stopped maybe 5 months later because I came to a meeting and I said to them, you know, I think I'm in a place now that I don't think alcohol is controlling me. And if I want to have a drink now, I do. I just control it and I don't let it be like a ghost. You know what I mean? Like I don't let it be a demon in my life. If I want to have fun, I have fun. I just don't get angry about it and overindulge anymore. And pretty much after I was done talking, the guy heading the meeting just ignored everything that I said and just said, just so you know. And he looked around at everybody and said, this is an abstinence only meeting. And I just took that as, you know, there's no gray lines. You either drink or you don't. And if you do, you're an alcoholic. And if you don't, you're sober. And I didn't want to label myself as an alcoholic anymore. It just doesn't seem right.
Well, and he could have said, hey, all of us have been there, thought we had a hold of our demons, and we really didn't. So maybe you should stick around for a while and work on this with us instead of just cutting you off in a sense.
Pretty much. I ran across an article a couple months ago. And I kind of put things in perspective. I think it might have actually been a podcast where they were talking about alcoholism. and my, I think it was Things You Should Know.
Mm-hmm.
And they were breaking down the different definitions of what alcoholism is. The actual term of alcoholism is a clinical definition that is determined by the quantity you drink with the symptom of having the shakes, like delirium tremens. And I never got to that point. Mm-hmm. I never drank that much. What I was a problem drinker that I binged, and I didn't stop until I felt like I don't even know what the limit was, because there really wasn't any.
You're out of control. You're abusing it, but you're not, you don't have that strong physical addiction, I guess.
Right. I never woke up and felt like I needed to drink. During that time, I think it might have been in between. It was before the DUI. That was probably when I was doing the most drugs.
Mm-hmm.
That was when I tried heroin for the first time, meth, cocaine. I probably drank 10 bottles of Robitussin a week.
Yeah, I got into the cough syrup for a while. It was gross.
Yeah, it's strange. It's very strange.
I even huffed paint for a while. I thought that was cool. It was.
I never did that.
You're probably better off.
Yeah, I'm okay. I'm trying to save the remaining brain cells I have left. Yeah.
But meth and heroin, that's two things I've never tried myself. You know.
You know what? I didn't really get into them, but I had a while I was doing my internship for archaeology, I had a roommate at the university. I didn't know it at the time, but. Because we just smoked pot, you know, when we came back from field work. It never really got beyond that. And once the semester started back up, he said that he went to a Grateful Dead concert and some guy hooked him up with acid. I said, I'll buy some tabs off you. You know, like, how much are they? So I bought that, started that on a regular basis. Then he had shrooms, got that. Then he started getting into heroin and... Hey, I never did heroin before, but I've taken pills plenty of times, and what? I know it's almost the same.
Yeah.
So I bought a handful of bags off of that off of him. He got meth one time. I tried that with him, and I can definitely say that for people that are willing to take prescription pain medications but think heroin's a bad thing, they're grossly mistaken. They're exactly the same.
Yeah, I mean, I've been kind of preaching it on the podcast that Adderall and meth, very similar, oxycodone, Oxycontin, Dilaudin.
Yeah.
I mean, all these painkillers out there who I've helped family members get off of, it was no different than getting a heroin addict off heroin.
Right. I actually listened to that podcast today, coincidentally, the War Against Drugs.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a good chat, by the way. But anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I never really got hooked on any of those. I think subconsciously I wanted to try them because I wanted to debunk the common myths that once you try, you're always chasing the dragon.
Yeah.
Maybe did heroin three times. I never woke up the next day needing it. I actually didn't even really like it. Meth is annoying. You know, you're pretty much racing for 15 hours. It's nothing. But yeah, definitely drinking and what was the other one? Cough syrup I was on for a long time too. But that was because I couldn't get my hands on anything else.
Yeah.
And I didn't have it. And there were stints where I didn't have a job. So and sitting around. Yeah. Oh, yes, it is. I mean, you can pretty much be tripping for 10 hours straight and you just spend $5.
And when you can get the prescription codeine cough syrups from the doctor. Oh my God. I remember.
I've never seen it.
It was terrible.
I'll need to build Lil Wayne.
No. We've gotten through three arrests.
The fourth one. The fourth and probably definitely the worst one. The one that could have put me away for a year.
So you drop out of AA and.
Then I just pretty much lived my life. Like there was nothing strange in that time span right before the fourth DUI was when I lost my license. I only lost it for 2 years. Oh, no, not 2 years, two months. So that was July and August. I think $2,000 worth of fines, and I had to take highway safety classes. In October, this is 2014, I believe. That was when I got my fourth arrest. Went out with a bunch of buddies drinking on one of the main streets in some town around here. I didn't drive. we didn't have anything to eat that night. And I remember saying to myself that I need to eat something big if we're going to be going out for hours on end drinking, because I knew how we do. So I wanted to make sure I ate something.
You got
to
build the base.
Yes, absolutely. I did not eat anything, but I drank normally anyway. Started getting the spins, started getting disgusted with myself. So I started walking home, which isn't that bad. It was probably maybe a half hour walk, you know, not that bad, mile or two. On the way home, I stop at another bar diner, grab something to eat, and of course a double shot of Wild Turkey to wet my whistle. Mm-hmm. There's a car dealership right across from that diner. I was blacked out during all this. I remember flickers of it. The next thing I remember is cops behind me shining their light on me, saying to drop what's in your hand, and it was my car keys. And they said that I keyed 30 cars up and down in the car dealership. Yeah.
I'm not even going to try to defend that action, but at least it wasn't people that own the cars, and the business hopefully has insurance or something, but...
Yeah, we're getting to that.
Yeah.
Yeah, we will. That was when I started going to not even therapy. I just went straight to a psychiatrist at this point. Mm-hmm. You know, like somebody that's gets that upset about their drinking or their actions is obviously unhappy. Not that I think medication is a way to alleviate responsibility from yourself, because I think a lot of times people will blame their depression or blame their anxiety or their poor actions on just generally their lifestyle. But the medications, they help me baseline myself again. And I think it was kind of funny how easily I was able to obtain these medications. I think I spoke to the doctor for at best 5 minutes.
Yeah.
I walked out with a prescription for naltrexone, which was it makes you like get sick if you start drinking too much. It's kind of like Suboxone for opiate.
Yeah, yeah.
Some sort of anti-anxiety. It was some sort of generic one. Adderall and a very expensive antidepressant. And this is all over a five-minute conversation. Yeah.
I can't even get my doctor to give me, like, sleeping pills after 2 hours of talking to him. So, whatever.
Yeah.
It all depends on the doctor.
Yeah, I took those for a little bit. But it didn't make me feel right. Strangely, I just started to feel artificial. The emotions I was having weren't real, but I did start to feel happy, and it calmed me down. Eventually, I just cold turkey stopped taking everything, maybe after 3 months. For one, I felt like a hypocrite because I always spoke out against it, saying that people that need to take medications like that are just avoiding the problems, and it was very expensive. Mm-hmm. So I stopped taking them. Went to court for
the vandalism and all that.
Yeah. The guy from the dealership, my family works in the automotive business as well. Mm-hmm. And we kind of know each other.
Ooh.
And yeah. And my dad and I went and had a chat with him. He said that the insurance was going to come after me for the bill, which was, I think, $21,000. And if we didn't pay it, or if the charges weren't dropped, then I'd be going to jail for a year. Also, because it was a violation of probation for my DUI. Now, I think this is something that happens to literally no one, but the owner of the dealership paid the insurance company, and he dropped all the charges. And he said that I seem like a good guy, and I'm a kid that was confused and unhappy at the time, doesn't think I'll ever do it again, and wishes me the best of luck. And every time my dad sees him now, he asks how I'm doing, and, you know, happy that I'm on the track that I am. You know, I have two jobs now, live in a apartment with my girlfriend, have a 2015 Jeep, you know, like I'm doing okay right now. And I think the thing that keeps me from acting that way anymore is the shame of laying down the people that have stood behind me every single time.
Yeah. You've lucked out severely with...
Oh, yeah.
And I'm sure these four incidents, those are just when you got caught. You know, we know that we fuck up a lot more than just when we get arrested.
You know, with my with my DUI, this is something that I always thought about too, that they caught me drinking and driving when I was on the downslope of my issue. They didn't catch me at the height of it. If they caught me a year and a half before then, when I was driving home blacked out every single night, I probably wouldn't have cared. I just would have been pissed off and wouldn't have tried to change anything. But they caught me 5 years into my drinking when I'm tapering down everything because I, you know, had a job. That's when I first started my archaeology job. Mm-hmm. I had the job. I had a really nice girlfriend that wasn't into drinking or drugs or anything. Like, things are working out. And I feel like getting that DUI was that extra push over the edge.
And it helps when your friends or girlfriend do not drink or smoke or anything. It helps you not do those things because you're not surrounded by it.
Yeah, absolutely. That same day that I got my DUI, that was on a Sunday. I went in Monday morning and got fired. Unrelated.
So you're just getting hammered. I mean, that's what happens when you start screwing up, is things start compounding. Like, if you couldn't have paid that fine, if that car dealership owner wouldn't have paid the fine for you, that would have been a violation of probation. It would just would have compounded and compounded.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I thought I was doing the right thing by, you know, walking home. I didn't want to drive with my friends. But in reality, the friend that we were driving around with, he lives like two blocks down the road, and we walked to the bars. I could have just waited it out and hung out with them. But you're drunk. You're not thinking straight. You just want to walk home and you want to get out of the situation. You're annoyed.
Yeah. People think meth and heroin make you choose bad decisions, but we all see alcohol make people do crazy stuff. And
absolutely.
It you don't need bath salts. Alcohol's bad enough.
Yeah, I mean, it might as well be. Give somebody that's in a bad mood enough alcohol. I mean, I was out with one of our neighbors the other day just drinking in his apartment. And his girlfriend just broke up with him, so he's drinking like a fish. Mm-hmm. That's not going to make it better, dude.
We have a mutual friend that her boyfriend and her were fighting. She told him over chat, "I'm going out and drinking tonight." And he said, "Maybe right now is a bad time to do that because you're not in a good state of mind." And she turned around and told us, you know, he thinks I'm an alcoholic. He thinks I'm a screw up. And I read his email or his message, and I'm like, no, he's worried about you, and you shouldn't go out and drink and make the problem worse. So,
you see, when she's saying that, that's what she thinks about herself, but isn't ready to admit it yet.
Yeah, that's what we kind of gathered, because at first I thought, well, you know, it's kind of a crappy thing for him to say until I read his message, and then I was like, oh, wait, it's you, not him.
Yeah. When you're in that state and you're not ready to accept it yet, someone telling you to, you know, hey, maybe you should calm it down a little bit. I don't know what you're supposed to say to the person that's having the issue, but telling them to relax is not, I don't know, it's kind of counterintuitive. Like, you're just going to make them want to drink more. But yeah, I mean, like today, like I still drink. I'll eat an edible if I'm in a mood to, but I haven't gotten any fist fights. No driving.
And
no
when
arguments.
When you drink, do you just have like one or two now?
It depends on my mood. Mm-hmm. If it's like a weekday or something like that, like scotch has been my thing lately, like a nice bottle of scotch. Like, I'll have a snifter of that, and that's usually it. If it's like a Sunday afternoon or Saturday night and I'm just like hanging out, I'll have like two or three of them, you know, something like that. But it's never to the point where I start being hurtful or saying things that I regret. That was a big part of it too. You know, drinking with people that I actually don't really respect, you know, like being with women that have the same issues that I do and me projecting those issues onto them. I'm not with somebody like that now.
Yeah.
You know, so when I drink, all the truth isn't coming out, you know?
I used to drink around people that I really just didn't care for. And so the only way to enjoy their company was to be drunk. And it made me drink more and more and more, just because that was the only way to cope with the idiots and the assholes that I hung out with. And why would you hang out with those people? If you can't stand them when you're sober, why do you have to leverage alcohol to make it tolerable?
Yeah, I don't really understand it either. But I mean, I did all the time for in that like 4 or 5 year span of time. Those were the only people that I hung out with.
Yeah.
All my other real friends went away. You know, I mean, like I said, like I'm drinking, but I'm not going out drinking at bars now that I'm not doing that anymore. Every single one of those people disappeared and all my childhood friends are back.
People that matter.
Yeah. 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 It's called growing up.
Yeah. I used to have drinking buddies. I used to have smoking pot buddies, but they're all gone. Once you stop drinking and stop doing drugs, they go away because that's all they want is somebody to be miserable with, I guess, if you want to call it that. But
yeah, I wouldn't say it's, I think that's something everybody says, like it's, you know, misery enjoys company, which is true too. But with the drinking buddies, I think it's just so much easier to do that than develop a skill. So they'd rather just hang out and drink and have fun and play video games, you know, fun.
Yeah.
Instead of, you know, going out and, you know, playing basketball or, you know, lifting or working at, you know, anything.
Any hobby.
It's just easier staying drunk.
I used to skateboard and then I started drinking. And of course, when you're drinking, you're not skateboarding anymore. And,
right.
I remember I won a first place competition once. I was trying to get a sponsorship, but by that point, I'd destroyed my life to the point where skateboarding wasn't my priority anymore. And,
right.
You know, I got out of it. But
My whole saga started in probably like 2009. I was a personal trainer at the time. And then I started drinking and I started missing clients and I got fired from that job. And then I don't think I worked out again for another like 3 years while I was busy building up my alcohol tolerance. And I often wish that if I got those 5 years back, you know, who wouldn't I have met? What are the low caliber people that I've dated? None of them would have been around. I probably would have still been engaged. I'd probably been married by now.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm with someone great today and we're about to get engaged. But had I not lost that person to begin with and I stayed on her level and was an adult when she was an adult, I would have saved myself a whole lot of grief.
And all the opportunities that you missed.
You know, graduating college 3 or 4 years later than I had to, not having a good GPA. I don't know. It's just, it's hard to think about, but I think, I mean, you have to keep moving forward and keep doing the best things that you can do today to make tomorrow better. But goddamn, if I don't think sometimes what I could have done given an extra 5 years of my 20s, a lot less hours trying to find pills and alcohol and more time trying to find grad schools.
How old are you now?
I'll be 30 in November.
30? I think you've pulled your head out of the sand. And I would hope that if you ever find yourself slipping into that angry place again, you would hopefully identify it. Now, when you're drunk, that's hard to do, but...
Oh, I do. Because every now and again, I'll find a stint where like I drink heavily for like 3 or 4 days straight, and I'll catch myself. I'm like, whoa, it's going back down that way. Like, got to stop for a couple of days or whatever and get my bearing straight.
Yeah.
But given how bad 2011, 12, 13, 14 were, 16's been the best, most productive year of my life. And I can only credit it to actually moving forward.
And being sober.
Yeah. The best thing that I think happened was moving in with my girlfriend and out of my parents' house because it got me out of the environment that kept me doing the same thing.
And you hate yourself because you live with your parents. You feel like you're a piece of dirt because you live with your parents. You're a failure, and then you drink more because you feel this way.
It was all compounded. Mm-hmm. Like 3 years before that, everybody lived with their parents. Fast forward 3 years, I barely graduated college. And I don't have any money to move out of my parents' house. And I'm upset that I don't have any money. So I go out every night drinking because I just want to feel okay for the night. And then you realize that you could have been out the whole time if you just haven't been messing up like that. You know, it's very strange why people do the things that they do. I think that was a lot of it.
Does your current girlfriend, does she know your past?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, she knows everything. I think that being the case, she's pretty aware of my habits. Like if she sees that I'm taking too big of a pour or keep going back to the bottle. Like, she'll tell me that, you know, you don't need any more. Mm-hmm. And if I go for like a week and drink too much, that's, you know, she'll let me know. It was slow beginning. I think I drank really heavily when we first got together for like the first 6 months. And then as I think that was just adjusting to my new lifestyle. You know, I'd never lived with somebody before that actually gave a shit about how I was treating myself, or at least acted like it. But I didn't want to ruin yet another relationship for the 10th time in a row because I couldn't stop drinking. Can drinking really be more important than your relationships? It's not. It's just not. No.
I guess you don't need the shakes to show the addiction, you know?
Right.
It's when when it is a coping mechanism right there. You're afraid of this new situation you're in. Therefore, the only way to cope with it is to drink. So, yeah, circular. Yeah.
It might not have been a physical addiction, but it was definitely an emotional one.
Mm-hmm. I would prefer somebody smoke pot than drink every day. At least it's easier on their body, but people don't acknowledge that if you're having to do something like that every day, it turns into an addiction, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. It's once again, it's not a physical addiction, but if you feel the emotional need to be altered that way every time, I don't know. I think that kind of person needs help too.
Yeah, they do.
But I think at the end of the day, you have to help yourself. You can go to AA meetings, you can go to therapy, but unless you actually want to change your behaviors, you have to be the one to do it, and it doesn't happen overnight. Mm-hmm. You didn't become an alcoholic overnight, so you're not going to be not one the next day. You know, it's going to take months and years to reroute how you think and repair your relationships, you know, all the physical and emotional damage you've caused people. How many people I've had to apologize for shit that I've said to them, you know, stuff to my parents, you know.
I like that you said reroute the way you think, because people will get stuck in this frame of mind, this path, this way they think, and it just keeps routing to a bad place, and you have to change that.
Yeah. And the only way to do it's the slow, progressive building of new habits to replace the old ones. I mean, you can't just stop doing what you're doing and expect other talents and hobbies and ways of life to just fit in there. Yeah. You have to find something else that you want to do, and now you don't have time to do that anymore because you have other priorities.
Absolutely.
You know, I mean, as much as I'd love to, I would love to have a Saturday or a Sunday just tripping on acid. but I can't anymore because there's other things in my life that need tending to.
Yeah.
You know, if I crush 12 hours of staring at the trees, as much as I like it, it's there's no place for it anymore. It was a lot easier when I was either single or dating another addict and didn't have a job, and they wanted to do the same thing too.
It sucks when you grow up, man.
I know. It was fun being stupid. You know, it just doesn't. It doesn't have a place anymore.
For the month of October, I'm going to be visiting some creepy and scary topics for the Halloween theme. We'll see how they go. So thank you for listening to this week's episode.
Ready for a career in behavioral health? Earn your online degree at Herzing University. Choose from health and human services, psychology, or social work programs. Gain the skills to work, coordinate, and manage nonprofits. Secure a bachelor's in psychology to study mental health or advance your social work career through our online Masters of Social Work. Let us help you become a social change agent. Your future starts now at Herzing University. Text HEALTH to 85109. That's HEALTH to 85109. Or visit herzing.edu.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.